The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good morning, everybody. This is Martin. This is the Wake Up Call coming to you from Singapore on this 18th day of October 2010. Well, okay, so I think I've come up with a definitively easy-to-understand story of the ongoing mortgage title deed scandal. Ladies and gentlemen, this will doubtless enable you to relate the story easily and effortlessly, thereby make each of you the life and soul of any party you may be attending in the next few weeks. And it comes to you courtesy of John Mortlin through David Kotok and an email correspondent that he wishes to remain anonymous. So, draw up your chair and get ready to grab an earful. Here goes. Homeowners can only be foreclosed and evicted from their homes by the person or institution who actually has the loan paper. Only the note holder has legal standing to ask a court to foreclose and evict, not the mortgage, the note, which is the actual IOU that people sign promising to pay back the mortgage loan. Before mortgage-backed securities, most mortgage loans were issued by the local savings and loan. So the note usually didn't go anywhere. It stayed in the offices of the SNL down the street. But once mortgage loan securitization happened, things got sloppy. They got sloppy by the very nature of mortgage-backed securities. The whole purpose of MBSs was for different investors to have different risk appetites satiated with different bonds. Some bond customers wanted super safe bonds with low returns. Some others wanted riskier bonds with correspondingly higher rates of return. Therefore, as everyone knows, the loans were bundled into REMICs, which are real estate mortgage investment conduits, a special vehicle designed to hold the loans for tax purposes, and then sliced and diced or split up and put into tranches according to their likelihood of default, their interest rates, and other characteristics. This slicing and dicing created senior tranches where the loans would likely be paid in full if the past history of mortgage loan statistics was to be believed. And it also created junior tranches, where the loans might well default, again, according to past history and statistics. A whole range of tranches was created, of course, but for the purpose of this discussion, we can ignore all those countless other variations. These various tranches were sold to different investors according to their risk appetite. That's why some of the MBS bonds were rated as safe as treasury bonds, and others were rated by rating agencies as risky as junk bonds. But here's the key issue. When an MBS was first created, or a mortgage-backed security, all the mortgages were pristine. None had defaulted yet, because they were all brand new loans. Statistically, some would default and some others would be paid back in full. But which ones specifically would default? No one knew, of course. If I toss a coin 1,000 times, statistically, 500 tosses, the coin will land heads. But what will be the result of, say, the 723rd toss? No one knows. Well, it's the same with mortgages. So, in fact, it wasn't the riskier loans were in junior tranches and the safer ones were in senior tranches. Rather, all the loans were in the REMIC, again, the real estate mortgage investment conduit, and if and when a mortgage in a given bundle of mortgages defaulted, the junior tranche holders would take the losses first and the senior tranche holders last. But who were the owners of the junior tranche bond and the senior tranche bonds? Two different people. Therefore, the mortgage note was not actually signed over to the bondholder. In fact, it couldn't be signed over because, again, since no one knew which mortgage would default first, it was impossible to assign a specific mortgage to a specific bond. Therefore, how to make sure the safe mortgage loan stayed with the safe MBS tranche, and the risky and or defaulting mortgage went to the riskier tranche? Enter stage right, the famed MERS, M-E-R-S, or the Mortgage Electronic Registration System. MERS was the repository of these digitized mortgage notes, and the banks originated from the actual mortgage loans signed by homebuyers. MERS was jointly owned by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Yep, those two again. I know. Just when you think you've assigned them all the blame that is their due, they just keep coming back for more. The purpose of MERS was to help in the securitization process. Basically, MERS directed defaulting mortgages to the appropriate tranches of mortgage bonds. MERS was essentially where the digitized mortgage notes were sliced and diced and rearranged so as to create the mortgage-backed securities. Think of MERS as Dr. Frankenstein's operating table, where the beast got put together. However, legally, and this is the important part, MERS didn't hold any mortgage notes. The true owner of the mortgage notes should have been the REMICs. But the REMICs didn't own the notes either because of a fluke of the rating agencies. The REMICs had to be bankruptcy remote, as they say, in order to get the precious ratings needed to peddle mortgage-backed securities to institutional investors. So somewhere between the REMICs and MERS, the chain of title was broken. Now, what does broken chain of title mean? Simple. When a home buyer signs a mortgage, the key document is the note. As I said before, that's the actual IOU. In order for the mortgage note to be sold or transferred to someone else, and therefore turned into a mortgage-backed security, this document has to be physically endorsed to the next person. All of these signatures on the note are called the chain of title. You can endorse the note as many times as you please, but you have to have a clear chain of title right on the actual note. I sold the note to Mo, who sold it to Larry, who sold it to Curly, and all our notarized signatures are actually physically on the note, one after the other. If, for whatever reason, any of these signatures is skipped, then the chain of title is said to be broken. Therefore, legally, the mortgage note is no longer valid. That is, the person who took out the mortgage loan to pay for the house no longer owes the loan because he no longer knows whom to pay. Let me repeat that. If the chain of title of the note is broken, then the borrower no longer owes any money on the loan, ladies and gentlemen. Do you see where all this is leading? Do you see the can of worms that's opening up here? The broken chain of title might not have been an issue if there hadn't been an unusual number of foreclosures. Before the housing bubble collapsed, the people who defaulted on their mortgages wouldn't have bothered to check to see that the paperwork was in order. But, as everyone knows, following the housing collapse of 2007-10 and counting, there has been a boatload of foreclosures, and foreclosures on a lot of people who weren't sloppy bums who skipped on their mortgage payments, but smart and cautious people who got squeezed by circumstances. These people started contesting their foreclosures and evictions, and so started looking into the chain of title issue. And that's when the paperwork became important. So the chain of title became crucial, and the botched paperwork became a non-trivial issue. Now, the banks had hired foreclosure mills, euphemistically so-called, which are law firms that specialize in foreclosures, in order to handle the massive volume of foreclosures and evictions that occurred because of the housing crisis. The foreclosure mills, as one would expect, were the first to spot the broken chain of titles. Well, what do you know? It turns out that these foreclosure mills might have faked and falsified documentation so as fraudulently to repair the chain of title issue, thereby proving that the banks that had judicial standing to foreclose on delinquent mortgages. These foreclosure mills might have even forged the note itself. Wait. Why am I hedging? The foreclosure mills did actually deliberately and categorically fake and falsify documents in order to expedite these foreclosures and evictions. Eve Smith at Naked Capitalism, who has been all over this story, put up a price list for this so-called service from a company called DocX. Yes, a price list for forged documents, which I actually sent out in an email to my general distribution list a couple of weeks ago. Gives new meaning to one-stop shopping, doesn't it? So, in other words, a massive fraud was carried out with the inevitable innocent bystanders getting caught up in the fraud. The guy who got foreclosed and evicted from his home in Florida, even though he didn't actually have a mortgage, and in fact owned his house free and clear. The family that was foreclosed and evicted, even though they had a perfect mortgage payment record. Etc., depressingly, etc. Now, the reason this all came to light is not because too many people were getting screwed by the banks, the government, or someone with some power saw what was going on and decided to put a stop to it. That would have been nice to see a shining knight in armor riding on a white horse. But that's not how America works nowadays. No. Alarm bells started going off when the title insurance companies started to refuse to insure the titles. In every sale, a title insurance company ensures that the title is free and clear, that the prospective buyer is in fact buying a property vetted house with its titles, issues, all in order. Title insurance companies stopped providing their service because, of course, they didn't want to expose themselves to the risk that the chain of title had been broken and that the bank had illegally foreclosed on the previous owner. That's when things started getting interesting. That's when the attorneys general of various states started snooping around and making noises. Elections are coming up after all. The fact that Ally Financial, formerly GMAC, J.P. Morgan Chase and now Bank of America have suspended foreclosures signals that this is a serious problem, obviously. Banks that size with that much exposure to foreclosed properties don't suspend foreclosures just because they're good corporate citizens who want to do the right thing and who have all their paperwork in strict order. They're halting their foreclosures for a reason. The move by the United States Congress last week to sneak by the Interstate Recognition of Notarizations Act, that was all the banking lobby. They wanted to shove down that law so that their foreclosure mills' forged and fraudulent documents would not be scrutinized by out-of-state judges. Of course, the spineless cowards in the Senate carried out their master's will by a voice vote so that there would be no registry of who had voted for it and therefore no accountability. And President Obama's pocket veto of the measure? He had to veto it. If he'd signed it, there would have been political hell to play. Plus, it would have been challenged almost immediately and likely overturned as unconstitutional in short order. But he didn't have the gumption to come right out and veto it. He pocket vetoed it. As soon as the White House announced the pocket veto, the very next day, Bank of America halted all foreclosures nationwide. Why do you think that happened? Because the banks are in trouble again. over the same thing as last time, the damned mortgage-backed securities. The reason the banks are in the same tank again is if they've been foreclosing on people they didn't have the legal right to foreclose on, then those people have the right to get their houses back. And the people who bought those foreclosed houses from the bank might not actually own the houses they paid for. And it won't matter if a particular case, or even most cases, were on the up and up. It won't matter if most of the foreclosures and evictions were truly due to the homeowner failing to pay his mortgage. The fraud committed by the foreclosure mills casts enough doubt that now all foreclosures come into question. Not only that, all mortgages come into question. People still haven't figured out what all this means. But I'll tell you, if enough mortgage-paying homeowners realize that they may be able to get out of paying their mortgage loans and keep their houses scot-free, that's basically a license to halt payments right now, thank you. It's basically a license to tell the banks to take a hike. What are the banks going to do? Try to foreclose and then evict you? Show me the paper, Mr. Banker, will be all you need to say. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a major, major crisis. The Lehman bankruptcy could be a spring rain compared to this happen. And if this isn't handled right and handled really quickly in the next couple of weeks at the outside, this crisis could also spell the end of the mortgage business altogether. Of banking, actually. Of civilized society. What do you think happens in a country where the citizens realize they don't need to pay their debts? Okay, well, here we are. I'll quickly give you my information and on we go. I am Richard Martin and have been for, well, the better part of 60-odd years now. I am at a toll-free number, 888-874-4888. That's the toll-free number to PRN's system, and you can talk to me and talk to a company here present simply by dialing that number yourselves. It is 888-874-4888. And if you'd like to email me, you may do that by emailing rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin, GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design .com. Once more, rm@gfawd.com. And if you want to call me direct with your questions about finances and personal situations you'd like to keep confidential, you may do that by dialing a number in Sarasota, which will come straight through to me in Singapore, and the number being area code 941-441-1682. Once again, 941-441-1682. Okay? And if you, well, basically that's what you need to do, and so let's have it, and we move on to, I think, a rant from Steve Kruger, which will be interesting, hopefully, for all of you to do, and it is as follows. Richard, you can't believe how happy we are to pay rent every month and to be free and clear. You no doubt heard the saying, the more bedroom in a house, the more opportunity for adultery. I say the more a country increases its money supply, unbacked by gold, the more it brings out the Madoff and the Ponzi in the population. It is as if all that bogus cash activates a dormant crook gene in humans. Real estate went from the oversold and overhyped American dream to a national group nightmare that is taking on global proportions. If the government decides it can raise more taxes by taking your property by eminent domain, it will do just that. Now the banks can toss you out of a home that you own free and clear as long as they process the paperwork fast enough. You won't know a thing until the sheriff knocks on your door telling you to get out. As Americans, it seems we are being reduced to moving to a warm city and staking out a park bench and exercising squatters' rights. As long as a family member stays on the bench, it becomes yours. When dreams get shattered, it's not a pretty thing. Steve Kruger. Thank you, Steve, as always, to the point and very, very apt. Well, while we're on the business of corruption, I thought I would read you something which I thought was very significant. It came from one of my favorite bloggers called Charles Hugh Smith, who writes the blog of twominds.com, all one word. He actually published a commentary last week from his accountant. And it seemed very apropos, and I thought I would pass it along to you, ladies and gentlemen. And this is how it reads. I belong to a large number of finance organizations, and sometimes I even assist clients with hiring a finance person. Since I have a lot of experience with finance and accounting, when I am interviewing these people, I know when I am getting a BS answer, and unlike most BS recruiters, I do not steer away from controversy, since I am truly looking for the most qualified for my clients, and not who is just most marketable to them. After I start drilling down, you'd be amazed, or maybe you wouldn't, how many of these CFOs and controller types were basically dismissed because they wouldn't cook the books in some manner. Now, maybe I have told you that I was asked to resign from one of the nation's largest companies, a company that I worked very hard for and saved from bankruptcy due to my actions that had been created in the U.S. because I refused to book a revenue entry for over $1 million, which was unsupported, and the CFO, I had been the CFO up until the merger, blew up with me when I asked him to send a memo telling me to record it. Funny, in a few years and one acquisition later, it melted down as one of the biggest accounting frauds in U.S. history. My next gig as the CFO was for a New York Stock Exchange company. I basically walked in and found what I would consider a $60 million accounting fraud in one day. And a mark-to-market issue draining cash flow and sucking the company into a dark hole. Corrected that accounting problem and the company began to prosper. But since I thought the board and upper management was so corrupt, I left. Chairman of the audit committee was found guilty at another large company for backdating options. The next public company, where not only was I the CFO, but prior to that, a board member, I was basically asked to resign for BS reasons a couple of weeks later, after I pointed out what the board was asking me to do was basically wire fraud. And of course, they backed off quickly and said they would get a legal opinion from our law firm, one of the top 10 in the U.S., to cover me. In the same meeting, our outside legal counsel said he had a problem giving such an opinion, and I pointed out that a legal opinion didn't keep me from being both civil and criminally liable. It should be noted that this was another company that 2 years before I came in and took the reins as CFO/COO and pulled the company out of black hole of looming bankruptcy and made it profitable for the first time in its history since it went public and then refinanced the company. In summary, a year after I left, the company had burned through the money I raised and the board sold the company for nothing. There is lots of bitterness out there with the straight-shooting finance people. Many of them find themselves unemployable. This stretches from banks, private equity, investment banking, through the large accounting firms. The average partner in the large accounting firms anymore is a pathological liar. To senior finance people in organizations. Right before Enron and MCI blew up, I actually had a BS human resources person tell me I wasn't flexible enough. I wanted to tell this idiot that I knew where flexibility got me, and it was an orange jumpsuit. Bankers and companies only hire the weakest and most pliable senior finance executives they can find. Oh, and one other short story. A while back, I was at a network meeting with a large group of CFOs and ex-CFOs. I asked this group how many thought that most CEOs wanted a weak CFO working for them. Approximately 70% of the attendees raised their hand. You have to remember that the only person who had steady access to the board is the CFO. The point The middle class is becoming torn and frayed, and there is real anger out there. The common belief is that only the liars and the thieves are moving ahead in this country. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that may be true. Time will tell. Okay, I think we are coming up to a moment in time where we take our break, so let me just read you one email, and then I'll take the break, and then we'll go on to a few more. Plenty of them out there. Richard, even though gloom and doom is so often the topic, your show is always a breath of fresh air when it comes to hearing the sobering truth on today's economy. I much rather be jolted by the truth than comfortably numb, so I really appreciate it. I just watched the Max Keiser report, where he predicts a bank holiday during which a devaluation adjustment of the US dollar could take place. Shortly after that, his guest Eric Janssen states that ultimately there is too much political pressure in all the countries that would be affected by a collapsing dollar, and instead they would try to decommission the dollar from being the primary reserve currency. By the way, I do recommend Eric Janssen. He's an excellent forecaster, and he writes the website itulip.com. So Eric Janssen, definitely worth your while. I better spell his name because it's a little bit difficult. I think it's probably Dutch. Janssen. That's Eric Janssen. Anyway, to continue with the email. Either way, it sounds like the US dollar is facing some bumpy times ahead. If I'm currently holding cash in US dollars, what would be the best investment choice to hedge any risk in the dollar's volatility? Would it be ETFs in other currencies? And if so, which ones? Euros, Canadian, or Swiss? SPDRs, that's spiders, in gold or other commodities perhaps? Or would owning physical currency or commodity be a better bet? Or is something totally different the answer? Some opinions out there pointing to global macro funds as an alternative to hiding the gold bullion under your mattress. So, in summary, if physical gold bullion is not practical for me, what can act as a hedge and maintain value even if the opposite deflation and strengthening of the dollar happens like it did in the first quarter of 2009? Regards, Daniel. Oh, well, Daniel, first of all, I never believe really in hedging. Hedging is simply a way of saying I don't want to show that I'm wrong, so I'll just take the other side of a situation that I'm invested in, and we'll have both the long and the short going together, so I'll just sit and I'll be right whichever way it goes, because obviously if one goes right, I'll be in profit, if the other goes right, I'll be in a loss in that situation, but I'll be in a profit in the first situation. So basically, I don't think you should hedge. If you believe that the dollar is going to rise in value, you should hold, in my opinion, treasury bills or CDs try to play the downside of various overbought markets like the stock market, maybe some of the commodity markets as well. If you think the dollar is going to go down, then I wouldn't hedge the dollar. I would buy foreign currencies. I think a basket of currencies is the way to go. As you point out, there's euros, there's Canadian, there's Swiss, there's even Singapore dollars, although I believe it's very difficult to get into the Singapore dollar if you don't actually live here or have business interests here. So one way or another, try to maintain the currency that you believe is going to work for you, and then you will at least know that if you're wrong, you can switch back into the original currency, and if you're right, you won't get hurt because you will be holding the short-term government investments of the national government of that particular country. So that's my advice to you in that particular situation. All right, I wouldn't hold any gold under the mat. Right now, I would not hold gold bullion per se. I do think that gold is going to fall, as many of you know, and I think that gold is maybe an investment for the future, but I don't think that it would be advisable to invest right now. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, and by the way, Daniel, thank you for the email. We will now take our break, and I will be right back.
to the Progressive Radio Network, celebrating 5 years of independent points of view.
Hi, this is Dr. Mayor Eisenstein. Every Thursday morning, 10 a.m. Eastern Time, I will be coming to you live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I will bring my background as a physician and as an attorney to help you with a minimal pharmaceutical and a minimal surgical approach to your medical issues. Please come join me.
So to join in on the conversation, call 888-874-4888. Ask Dr. Eisenstein, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, only on Progressive Radio Network.
I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one form that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
You're listening to Bhavani, and I'd like to welcome you every Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network to join me for my show called I Eat Green, where every Wednesday we will talk about eating healthy and eating sustainably for our planet. So join me every Wednesday from 5 to 6.
I'm Dr. Cheryl Selman. I invite you to join me every Monday at 2 p.m. to listen to What Women Must Know, a show with a purpose to empower women with truthful information and in-depth, honest, candid conversations regarding holistic solutions for their bodies, their hormones, and pertinent life issues. So that's 2 p.m. every Monday on Progressive Radio Network.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Here's another email from somebody on the dollar question that I thought I might just let you have right away while we're still hot on the subject. From Ken Nessler, who writes, "Dear Richard, if the dollar collapses, then would that not drive dollar-denominated commodities in the stock market higher? Both these asset classes have rallied as the dollar has weakened over the past 6 weeks. Could a rapid and severe decline in the dollar collapse send us into hyperinflation? It is my understanding that hyperinflation is different from classic inflation, not just by degree, but also by its genesis and the way it manifests. I agree with you that deflation should be the natural course of things, given the tremendous debt and derivatives that need deleveraging. But do you not believe that the people controlling monetary policy in the U.S. will continue to avert deflation by printing money ad nauseam? Or do you think that there is some sort of self-limiting mechanism that will sort of rip hands from the throttle? Think of this. When caught between the proverbial rock and a hard spot, which do you think those who control monetary policy would opt for, given their druthers, currency failure-based hyperinflation or deflation? Given Sophie's choice and its scenario, if you will, which would be the path of lesser pain for these money changers and the current political leadership, term used loosely at large? Please understand, I do not have a firm opinion on the deflation-inflation debate. Until recently, I saw no other way to go but massive deleveraging and hence deflation. But lately, this notion of a dollar-debased hyperinflation has me concerned. In my sock puppet assessment, the only out for the U.S. government is hyperinflation, since it is an alternative to default. There is more of a saving grace element to it versus the humiliation of defaulting. Also, I feel that Americans, nitwits that we are, would be less averse to a 401k which is numerically greater than it was at the peak of the boom days, even though the inflation-adjusted value is far less than B, the same retirement fund, numerically shriveled from where it was at the peak, but whose dollars could buy far more. So the important question begs, can the PTB, that's the powers that be, engineer a hyperinflation outcome, or is it simply out of their reach? Or would it behoove said PTB to not choose hyperinflation in the light of inevitable deflation, even if they had the capability to do so? Best regards, Ken Nestler. P.S. I largely agree with you, decline of an empire assessment, and I enjoy your broadcast. Okay, Ken. The question, very simply put, is are we in for deflation or hyperinflation, and can the government take care of it? Answer, the government has no control. The government's never, ever are able to manipulate anything. They have never done so, and they never will. It's very important to understand this, ladies and gentlemen. And I'm glad that Ken has sort of brought this up through asking the same question sort of in a different way during his email here. Governments really are nothing more than the bystanders in a game of, beggar my neighbor. Everybody in life wants to do well, and most people in life have a desire to do better than their next-door neighbor. This is the nature of people. This is how they are. This is how they have always been and how they always will be. Now, governments come along, and they try to skew the issue. They try to make it seem like they know best what's good for you, and they will try to force you to succumb to their wishes. And what the Federal Reserve is trying to do now is to force everybody to buy things, to force prices higher, just like they did in the 1930s, and basically to create some kind of inflation that they were so keen on tamping down, 25, 30 years ago. Well, it's nonsense, ladies and gentlemen. The government can do nothing. They cannot force inflation to rear its ugly head just because they decide to print money. And so the nature of your question, Ken, is skewed to start with, because deflation will take place whether they like it or not, simply because the general public have overplayed their hand. They have immense debts to pay down or to default on, and therefore they're not in a position to go out and spend money. And when you're seeing people spending money right now, all you're seeing is the tail end of a system that was flawed to start with. The idea that governments could just give money to people and enable money to spend. It cannot last. It truly is the Ponzi scheme to beat all Ponzi schemes. Funnily enough, I was reading my paper this morning here in Singapore, the Straits Times, which is the sort of flagship paper of the island. Headline was critics slam the Fed's money printing. Now, it was particularly shocking to read that as the headline in the paper, not just because it's true, but because in the United States you will never see in a headline the word money printing, because the government wants the media to use the expression quantitative easing, which means, of course, the same thing. So although you'll read money printing, perhaps, if you're lucky, in the body of an article, you'll never read it as the title. And I assure you, it is very shocking to see it, because it conjures up images of what is really going on, which is counterfeiting, official, legal, government-sanctified counterfeiting by the Fed. That's to say, printing money for which there is absolutely no need or desire or call whatsoever. And believe me, when that money is printed, if it ever is, it will stay in the books of the banks on deposit with the Fed, because nobody will ever use it, ladies and gentlemen. The foreclosures and the defaults in the houses are much, much too hard-hitting right now for anybody to think about causing inflation on anything. It's a non-event. It's a fantasy in the mind of Ben Bernanke, as he goes to bed at night dreaming whatever dreams he has, which are probably dreams none of us want to know anything about. It's just nonsense. And so don't worry. that your money is going to suddenly lose value as prices shoot up. These recent price rises in commodities are simply nothing more than the way in which money finds its way to various different investments for the duration. But the prices will come right back down again, ladies and gentlemen, because nobody's going to buy those commodities at those prices. Believe me, it's not going to happen. So don't get inveigled by the nonsense that you read in the paper, the things that people say, questions that are asked of you, and above all, of the shenanigans that are painted, you know, by the Federal Reserve. They're all nonsense. All right, well, that's the best I can do for you on that one, Ken. Hope it answered your question adequately. A quick question from John Hilo, H-I-L-O, John, who writes in saying, "Hi, Richard. I have been shorting the markets for a long time now and have lost a lot of my patience of late. Can you please reassure me and others who have been shorting that this is still a good strategy? Thank you, Richard. All the best, John Hilo." Yes, Jordan, I can. Basically, it's the same question as the deflation, hyperinflation question. These stocks are overvalued, John. They are way overvalued. There is no place for stocks at these levels. And this is one of the best, if not the best, shorting opportunity I have ever seen, in my opinion. Because basically what is happening is there is a seething mass of people that have signed on to the Fed's approach. The Fed, which caused QE2, or rather QE1, which was the first money printing 2 years ago, it didn't work. There has been no recovery in the economy. Ask all the people, the 41 million people who are living below the poverty line on food stamps, what they have to say. It's nonsense. And the fact that the stock market is now teetering on the edge here of prices which are absolutely fantasy prices is nothing more than a heaven-sent opportunity for people who are considering selling short the market to sell short the market, because quite frankly, ladies and gentlemen, this cannot last. And all you need to do is to have a level head, calm down, and realize that you are dealing with a bunch of madmen in the government, and they are incompetent, and they are full of ego, and they will never prevail, because what they want to do is simply inimical to the system as it is set up today. There will be no hyperinflation. It's not possible. The currency doesn't call for it. People are not living in Zimbabwe, where they basically printed currency for people to go out and spend, which they had no need for either, but which at least they had the right to spend because the government simply gave them the money. And it didn't lead anywhere except to wheelbarrow loads of money to go in and buy a loaf of bread, just as it did in Germany in the 1920s. There again, in Germany, there was a reason why the government gave them the money, to forcibly reduce the value of the money that were reparations payable to the Allies for the loss of the First World War. It didn't work. The Germans got screwed in the bargain, and basically it spawned Hitler and created the Second World War. Great idea. Not going to happen, ladies and gentlemen. Don't worry about it. Okay? And while we're on the subject of the First World War and the Second World War, it is really quite extraordinary that people don't understand that they had exactly the same purpose, which is basically to allow Germany to flex its muscles, to expand the German population. Japan was starving economically. It had already conquered Korea, and it was gaining ground in Manchuria and China. There was no other choice. There had to be a genocidal war, because there wasn't enough food in the world to feed everyone. Well, today there are, once again, too many people. There are 6.5 billion people in the world, and by my rough estimates, the population would have to be reduced to about 4.5 billion to have the same amount of food per capita as in 1950. As world population has continued to increase, and since the gains from the 1960s Green Revolution petered out in the 1990s, and as food per capita has been decreasing, the price of food has been increasing dramatically around the world, and around the world there are megacities, each containing tens of millions of people with no access to farmland. Families in poverty in those cities often survive by foraging in large garbage dumps for scraps of food left over by people who can afford to buy food. And as population continues to increase, this problem of megacities is going to multiply. These problems have occurred in cycles throughout human history and have got many times worse in the last two centuries because of medical discoveries which have lowered the infant mortality rate from 40 to 50% to 1 to 2%. And that's why, for example, the death rate as a percentage of population was 10 times higher in World War II than it was in the Napoleonic Wars. I hate to tell you this, but we're approaching this clash of civilizations world war at a time when infant mortality has fallen far, leading to masses of people who are packed by the millions into large megacities in a fragile world where any economic dislocation can cause mass starvation, creating huge pools of young men ready for war. Many of these megacities are already mega slums around the world, filled with hundreds of millions of people squatting on marginal or toxic land, drinking filthy water filled with excrement, just barely surviving on the garbage left by others. And here's where you see the real power of terrorists. Because terrorist acts can inflame populations, and when you have a huge mass of young men who can't feed their families and have to forage for food in garbage dumps, then they have nothing to lose by spontaneous riots, civil wars, or external wars. At least when you're in an army, you get fed and you get paid with money you can send back to your family. For example, the effects of explosive population growth is especially clear in China. There are tens of thousands of mass riots every year in China. There are over 100 million migrant workers, high unemployment, high food prices, high income disparities, and addiction to a bubble economy, unraveling of Mao's social structure, and several provinces threatening to secede. And recently, Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao said that China is, and I quote, unsteady, unbalanced, uncoordinated, and unsustainable. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, those are the Chinese Premier's exact words. China is becoming increasingly unstable. It is approaching a civil war and a resulting world financial and war crisis. Incidentally, one of the largest megacities in the world is Mexico City, the capital of Mexico, with some 20 million people. A major financial crisis will strike Mexico very hard, as well as many other countries with poverty-stricken megacities. One can safely predict that Mexico is headed soon for a new civil war along the European indigenous fault line, and that this civil war will spill over into southwestern U.S., especially in California, where a third of the population is Mexican. Well, back to the dollar. Most of you have probably seen how the dollar has been collapsing recently against the other major currencies. Well, you do need to know that a falling dollar is a big problem for the American economy. Most economists will tell you that it's good for exports and it helps make debt easier to repay. Well, it most certainly does not make debt easier to repay when wages are still arbitraged by overseas workers. That process forces wages down, not up. On top of that, you are going to have higher energy and food costs, and your cheaper dollar has just killed off your consumer-based economy. Always remember that the Fed is the private banks. They make their decisions based on the best interests of the banks, who have created a debt money system for themselves that benefits them and requires never-ending growth. So-called modern-day economists are trained in schools funded by these criminals, and they are taught things that have no basis in a debt-based economy or that are just patently false. Look at the earnings of these banks. J.P. Morgan Chase, $4.4 billion during the third quarter. Come on, give me a break. Foreclosures are zooming, bankruptcies are zooming, defaults are zooming, and a huge crisis of confidence in the very structure of the American loan system is underway, and yet they have good gall to lower their loan loss reserves. I tell you, I wouldn't want to be within 100 miles of America when the American people find out how they've been fleeced. It will not be a pretty sight. All right, well, let's have a look at another email coming from Laura Musgrove, who says, "Hello, Richard. Just tuned in and heard the last part of your discussion on the mortgage issue. How can we homeowners and mortgage holders know if the companies have the paper or not? Thanks, Laura Musgrove. Well, Laura, that's the problem. You can't. Because even if you see the paper, you can't know where it came from. We're dealing with now a murky back issue of paper which either has no provenance or whose provenance may well have been forged by these companies who are just forging documents and selling them out to all and sundry. That's the problem we're having. That's why it's so very serious. That's why, you know, probably it will have a disastrous effect on real estate, because nobody's going to want real estate without having proof and good title to what they're buying. We saw this a few years ago in Spain, where people bought property on the south coast and then discovered that they had no right to the property because the town councils had forbidden any development on the property and the developers had just ignored the instructions. And so the people with the property had came to their property and saw it being bulldozed as the town gave orders for the destruction of property that was never zoned in the first place. Well, it's not that kind of issue we're dealing with right now, but it's not far from it. And that's the profit. That's the situation that we're living with right now. All right. Let me see what else I have. I got an email from Laurie Utecht, who says, "Hi, Richard. Thanks for the opening on the mortgage disaster. I can understand, I think, what effect this has on those whose mortgages are underwater. Can you talk a bit more about what the situation means for those of us who have more equity than debt against a property? Also, I have seen information about how to find out who owns your mortgage at a site called Where's the Note? We'll be interested to hear what you think, perhaps on Friday, if you'd like to have a chance to have a look at the site." Well, I will have a look at the site. In the meantime, I will tell you, Laurie, that obviously it depends on how long you've held the property. It also depends on where you are in the situation. I mean, if, for example, if anybody's coming after you for the property because of a recent action on the property, you do stand to have more of a problem defending yourself. But having more equity than debt against the property probably means that you bought it a while back. And so you're probably fairly safe. If you bought your property before 2002, I'd say you're probably out of the woods. But, of course, you know, again, Laurie, without having access to your particular situation, I really can't advise you more fully than that. So we're going to have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. All right, so we get an email now from Nikki, who says, "Hi, Richard. I would love your advice on something. My 61-year-old mother was laid off from her job 2.5 years ago and has been unable to find another job since. I am 33, but can still live at home since she can't make it on her own. I pay the mortgage, and she pays the other bills. Since unemployment ran out months ago, she started living off home equity lines of credit, but that now is also running out. As foreclosures, and what the banks have been doing lately has been in the news a lot lately, do you think we should chance it and stop paying the mortgage and just concentrate on other bills? What are your thoughts? There is no other family that can help, and I can't contribute more than I already am. Looking forward to hearing your thoughts, Nikki." Well, Nikki, in a situation like that, I am always for the idea that as possible, you might want to consider seriously not paying the mortgage. But before you do anything, Nikki, you must consult an attorney. If only because the laws in each state are dramatically different, and you have to find out whether these mortgages are recoverable or not, among other things, the effect that it may have on other debts you may have. And this is definitely something which you need to ask a professional about, and that it goes for everybody, ladies and gentlemen. If any of you are considering not paying that mortgage, you'd better consult an attorney before you do anything. It'll cost you a few hundred dollars, but believe me, it's a few hundred dollars well spent. All right, let's see what else we have here. In the matter of the broadcast of Friday and the silver certificates that I talked about, which is an unfortunate hole in my own personal knowledge of these things, we got some interesting emails on Friday, and I got a very interesting email from John Dusmanis, that pertains to the matter of the silver certificates that were created by John Kennedy back in the 60s that I knew nothing about and that were the subject of a call-in from one of the callers. So let me just read to you John's email in that regard. It starts, "Hi, Richard. I'm just listening to your Friday broadcast. On the matter of silver certificates, they were real and put in circulation by the U.S. Treasury. I have some in my collection of coins. I can dig them out and mail you a copy of the back and front of them, if you like. They clearly state on them the U.S. Treasury will pay the bearer in silver the face value on demand. What happened was Kennedy realized that the government was paying billions in dollars and fees to the Federal Reserve Bank for services that the U.S. Constitution required the Treasury to perform. He issued two executive orders. One was the Treasury was to start to issue its own currency, which was to be backed by silver, which the U.S. government had tons of in vaults. The second order was for the U.S. government to take over the Federal Reserve banking system at the end of the year. I remember reading a while back the 10th of the century legislation that set up the Federal Reserve had a takeover value inserted in it of $450 million, which was a fraction of the cost the U.S. government was paying the Fed for services it was performing in 1963. If you look at the chart of who owned the Fed, you will see two brothers. One was Secretary of State at one point, and the other headed up the CIA. After the Bay of Pigs failure, Kennedy went after the head of the CIA for the faulty intelligence and a very embarrassing fiasco. I know the silver certificates were real, as I have some in my collection. What I have not checked out was the information about the Fed takeover, which I read recently. This should be easy to do. If it is correct, you have the reason Kennedy was knocked off. What is interesting in private industry, if you have any gap or problem with your employment history, no one will hire you. Yet Oswald, who publicly defected to live in the USSR, was able to return to the USA with a Russian wife and get a job with a major defense contractor who was doing work at that location that required some staff to have a security clearance. This says it all. He had ties to the intelligence agencies. John Dusmanis." Well, thank you, John. Yes, indeed, I was aware of most of what you say. It is true that Kennedy was unhappy, to put it mildly, with the Federal Reserve. He didn't believe that they had the right to issue the currency. He did believe that the U.S. Treasury was supposed to issue the currency and should. Of course, that never came to pass. And there was, of course, the very famous ruckus that he had with the CIA and, of course, the Bay of Pigs. He really caused a lot of trouble for himself, and it is very clear to many sentient people that he caused his own demise by so doing. And so, quite frankly, very interestingly as it may be, we did indeed have to deal with this situation in years afterwards, as people, you know, did claim that there was some deficiency in the Federal Reserve's mandate. And indeed, the whole concept of the constitutional power to prevent the Federal Reserve existing by virtue of the fact that all its powers should devolve to the Treasury. And we've known that, and we've known that for a very long time, and I've talked about that many times in the past, ladies and gentlemen. And the Federal Reserve is indeed not only an illegal institution, but it is, in point of fact, utterly and totally incompetent. And it serves entirely the interests of the banks, and indeed what it is doing now proves just exactly that. And one has to wonder just how much further the Federal Reserve will go before the people of the United States rise up and indirectly put an end to it. And I think that's going to happen. In fact, I'm quite certain that's going to happen. The only question in my mind is how long it's going to take before it does happen. And this the QE2 threat that they have put out in the form of Ben Bernanke, much of which they say has already started to happen in the POMOs, that's the permanent open market operations that they're putting out weekly right now. Once that has been seen to be a failure, and once that has had the effects that it's going to have, unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, I have to tell you, there will be anarchy. There has to be anarchy because people simply will not accept that their hard-earned money turns to and that it is the fault of an organization which was illegal to start with. A very unpleasant, ugly situation, and one which I'm afraid to tell you will have a very sticky and unpleasant ending. All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is it, the end of another edition of the Wake Up Call. I'll be back on Friday. Have a wonderful week, and all the best to you. See you then. Bye-bye.